You're listening to Reach Teach Talk with Nat Dean.
Welcome back to another episode of Reach Teach Talk. We are really excited today to have as our guest Mr. Brian Eady, who is a filmmaker here based in Los Angeles, and he has a movie coming out on January 23rd nationwide called A Case for Love. And the reason why I was so excited when Brian agreed to come on our podcast today is because of the theme of this movie. In the title is the word love. Love is something that is in high demand these days, and yet we're having a harder and harder time perhaps seeking it out. And there's, as you know, this podcast, Reach Teach Talk, is about relationships, relationships in the classroom, relationships in schools, in our communities, and relationships in what we call the classroom of life. Brian's movie, A Case for Love, is a movie that should be screened by everybody, every listener out there, as well as every middle school and high school student. And the reason why I believe that to be the case is because the topic of love deserves attention. It deserves definition. It's a heck of a broader definition than one might think, particularly if you're a middle school or a high school student. You can love your friend. You can love your parents. You can love a significant other. You got romantic love. You have filial love. There's all types of love, devotional. And the love that is at the center of A Case for Love is what Brian will elaborate further on, but it's called selfless love. And if you are a school leader, an educator, somebody who's involved in supporting a school in your neighborhood, I would really hope that after this podcast, you consider asking your school to screen this movie. And it is structured in such a way that there are 14 different stories in A Case for Love of everyday people doing remarkable things driven by a force. Let's say a force, not just a feeling or an energy, but it's truly a force of selfless love. And think about it. These middle school kids or high school kids have grown up with a lot of stress and a lot of anxiety in the world around them and in their personal world. And they are looking for love. They're looking for hope all around. And this movie, if nothing else, presents 14 different stories of people engaged in hopeful action that is driven by selfless love. So as we start here, and before we jump into the movie, Brian, tell us a little bit about yourself. How did you get into the movie business? How did you get out here to LA? And ultimately, what led on your path to A Case for Love?
Well, first, thank you for having me here. This is fantastic. I'm excited to be here and talking about this. And so I'm originally from Iowa, the great state of Iowa in the Midwest, bounced around a fair bit. My father is a Lutheran pastor. My mother is a devout Catholic. So we were going to the seminary. He went as a second career to the seminary when I was in high school. So that took me to Iowa. And while there, I got a job in a movie theater. And it was through all the hours of becoming the front desk to the concessions and ultimately to the projectionist that I was around film and storytelling and dreaming. And I remember spending 6.5 years there, and nobody in Iowa in the 90s was talking about how to make movies. So there was no mentor or guide. But I remember dreaming about like what that might be like someday to tell stories through film and through the lens and then be on the big screen. So I was there. I graduated from Wartburg College in Waverly, Iowa, went and moved to the big city of Des Moines for a little while to get our big break, met a couple of other friends. We were going to be huge actors. And then we realized very shortly on that that was not going to happen in Iowa. As much as we loved living there, we needed to get to a bigger city. So I knew LA was too big for me at the time. It seemed unfathomable to move there. So we went to Dallas, was there for a year, met my beautiful wife as a waiter, as actors do. And then within a year had moved out to Los Angeles and became involved in the what I call the entrepreneurial school of filmmaking. When you don't have film school access or mentors, you learn by doing and making a lot of mistakes. And that's been my 20 plus year journey in this business.
If you could break down a bit your what I would call your cinema paradiso years when you were working in the theater, the movie theater, and you were really like taking jack of all trades. What kind of sparked that love for movies? Why? Because I mean, you were working it, but like, you know, I was a bag boy at a local grocery store, but I'm not working in a supermarket today.
Yes. There are benefits. I mean, you got paid, I think, $4.35 an hour back then. And so clearly you weren't doing it for the money.
The ancient years. Yes.
I think the first part is that most of the people in that space are happy. You know, it's date nights. It's for people. It's anniversaries. It's, you know, first dates. It's friends just gathering. So I think just being in a space, which is why I'm partial to movie theaters and the uniqueness of that, there's something about that shared experience that was kind of first and foremost amazing. And then, you know, you're in front of this massive screen when the lights go down and you're taken to another place that you would never be able to go in real life. And for me, usually that was historical. You know, you could go back in time and experience the Civil War or whatever that was. And film allowed that to happen and the imagination to mix with reality a little bit. And I think as somebody that was in high school theater and, you know, all those kinds of imaginative things, there was just, it took it to a different level in my imagination that hooked me.
Yeah. And you took it from imagination, kind of a fantasy, to a very, very significant reality in your life. I mean, you have made a career now as a filmmaker. Mm-hmm. If you can think about what you didn't know back then and when you were ideating and what you know now about making a film, what is like one big takeaway about the actual process of making a film?
Well, I think that one of the biggest lessons I've learned over the years and have shared with young people is that there's no rule book. You know, my wife's an attorney. She knew at 13, you go to school, that school gets you this degree gets you this job gets you that pay, you know, and here's the progression. And I think that doesn't exist in this business. And we can read a book about how Ron Howard did it or, you know, how John Travolta did it, but you're never going to replicate what Steven Spielberg did. It's just not going to be the case. So I think there's a fearlessness to it that is critical. And what I tell young people now is that like you have to want it more than anybody else because there's so many incredibly talented people around this space and so few opportunities that there's just a mindset of making something happen that I wish I would have known more then. But yeah, you learn in over the journey.
What I find most fascinating about what you just shared there is that it sounds like for you anyhow, and perhaps for many who get into the movie making business, you're looking at entering into a career in storytelling and it's a visual storytelling. And at the same time, what you're just saying is, but no, like your story in getting to this career is your own and no two stories are alike, whether you're Brian Glazer, whether you're Ron Howard, whether you're Steven Spielberg, whether you're Brian Eadie. Your story, your narrative is running parallel to this, you know, this career that you're striving for, which is based on story. There's something really cool about that. And I love also that you were sharing that you do talk with other kids and children and, you know, teenagers about your story and about and as a way to inspire them toward achieving their story. Which is all based in the storytelling of filmmaking. So I think that's really, really cool. And I would like to jump ahead into A Case for Love because by talking about your work with kids and inspiring them and the way that my intro led into the importance of this movie for teenagers and adolescents and schools, what do you see? What is this movie solving for in your mind? You're also a father. I know you have a son and a daughter. What do you think this movie can solve for parents, teachers out there in terms of what teenagers need today?
That's a big question, right? If only we knew. if only we knew. You're right. You know, my son is 20. My daughter is 15. So we are right in that kind of pivotal high school and college age. And I feel like over the last, especially the last handful of years, there is an absorption of toxicity and fear and uncertainty that they're absorbing at a rate that I don't remember absorbing when I was that age. And I think what I have come to love about the journey of making this film and now with the film is that I think that story can cut through what's otherwise kind of a headline-based world that these kids are. You know, they're absorbing facts based on headlines. And I think that what we've done in the film is we did not seek out 14 experts on unselfish love. That was intentional from the very beginning. Like, this is not a dissertation on unselfish love. This is a journey with people to remind ourselves what it's like to be with people again. And then hopefully the viewer interprets what they need to interpret from those stories. And so one example of that, and this takes us back to the young people question that you asked, is, you know, the range of stories are military or adoption stories or sexually trafficking stories or volunteerism or whatever themes they are. But ultimately, the film isn't a sexually trafficking film or a military film or any of those things. And so people that, when we've done test screenings leading up to the big event, have watched the film, and there's something about an unexpected story that then speaks to them in ways they hadn't expected. So we did a screening for a National Association of Military Chaplains to see. We have two military stories. And our hope was that we did justice to these military stories. I'm not in the military, and so you're nervous about that. Did we do right by them? And so people would come up to us and afterwards and say really wonderful things, and yes, this will be a great tool, and we're happy. And then one of the chaplains came up and said, you know, of course the Marine story and the Navy story we'll use, and they're going to be powerful. But I work with cadets that are 18 to 25 years old, and those cadets haven't experienced the PTSD of this retired Marine story. But your story about the woman who was sexually trafficked at a young age is exactly what my cadets are going through, because many of them have come through those similar difficult childhoods that led them to be in the military. And so it's a long-winded way of saying, I think for young kids, I think kids are really good at watching story, observing story, and then personalizing it to them. And I think they trust. There's something really powerful about sitting and creating intimate space with somebody in their home, not knowing them beforehand, and creating safe enough space for Jason to share Jason's story or Rosa to share her story. And I think young people are so hungry for authentic, that word gets thrown around a lot, but like really true stories that they at least believe you believe what you're saying, and they can figure that out, but they know that this isn't some bait and switch propaganda kind of slick thing. And I think that's where it's going to do its greatest space, is that these are truthful things, and you can agree or disagree or wrestle with something, but you're going to do it from a place of truth, because this is just their story.
That is brilliant, because you know kids, yeah. And they are. If nothing else, they can suss out disingenuousness, yeah, from day one, from the first 5 minutes of a first day of a new class with a new teacher.
Right.
Right?
Like, yeah.
And I love what you said earlier about the fact that, yeah, you know, I could have had 14 PhDs on love and on the philosophy and the esoteric, you know, nature of it, but that wouldn't be nearly as engaging, and certainly we wouldn't be here today promoting this film, particularly to an audience of parents and educators and students, if it weren't for the fact that you've got these 14 incredible stories based on, again, they're everyday people. Yeah. And I've seen Case for Love, like True Confession, like five times at least through and through. And what I feel every time with every story in A Case for Love is a sense of vulnerability. Yeah. And the word authenticity gets thrown around a lot and cited today, and it's always for good. But there is a sincerity there that kids will lean into, because they will believe and they will know that this is true. I want to also just make a really important point for everybody listening, is there is a story about a sex worker, somebody who is sex trafficked, right? Yep. And that might throw some of you off, listeners. Like, of course, you know, like, why would I show this in my school? Yep. If there's, you know, and I'd love for you to hear your thoughts on this. But if you don't mind, I'd love to just share kind of my thought about this, because it is something that I've seen. I've seen her story a time and time again by watching your movie. And I think it is 100% appropriate, because this is actually about forgiveness in my mind. This is about somebody who was put into a situation with absolutely no fault of her own. She was young. And the person who put her into this situation is somebody very dear to her, very close to her. And it is remarkable. It still literally takes my breath away when I think about when this woman, looking back at her life or her early years as a sex worker, actually forgives the person who put her in that situation. That's the lesson to me.
Yeah.
And that is a lesson that every kid, every teenager would lean into, because how do you forgive somebody for doing that? Mm-hmm. What is one's capacity for forgiveness? And that is the most powerful lesson to me in that story. And also, I also bring it up specifically because the way the movie is laid out is you've got 14 separate stories. So if you're screening this film, and if ultimately you don't feel comfortable sharing that one, you don't have to show it. Mm-hmm. You can skip ahead to the next story. Mm-hmm. I mean, mm-hmm. Are you nodding in agreement? Is there something that I'm missing here, or something that you would fill in on as well about that?
I completely agree. And I think one of the beautiful things about that chapter, and for the listeners, you know, these stories are woven together into chapters, and it's usually two or three stories woven together in a more universal theme. So the chapter is not sex trafficking. So this particular chapter where the film opens is about being dealt a difficult hand in life. And I think that's the universality of that chapter, which I've loved. And so, you know, the two stories that are woven together is Sheila, who you've just described, and then Tim Shaw, a former NFL football player who was diagnosed with ALS at a very young age and had all of that career life and now his mobility ripped away from him. And there's something about the
Say it five times fast.
There we go. There
one
we go.
One time slow.
Yeah, we'll beep that. So there's something about that intersection, stories that I think, you know, it takes us from being fixated on, is this about sexual trafficking? No, this is about being dealt a difficult hand. And now I get to witness two very different, very, unfortunately, very extreme stories of that. But I think a lot of the people around us and a lot of kids will see that also and be like, okay, my version of that is different, but no less impactful to me. And I think that's the power of story too, is that yes, it's about sexually trafficked stories and people's lives. And there's a lot of people that have unfortunately had to live in that space, but it's about something bigger to that too. And the bigger thing connects a lot of people. And that's what I love about that. And we intentionally, in the creation of the film, that chapter was first, because I remember when we sat down with a dear friend who's a very experienced writer in Hollywood, and he says, okay, you're making this film about unselfish love, and at some point you're going to have this guy that's in a collar talking about it. As a viewer, like, my assumption is I already know what this film's about. He said, so your job is to say, oh, you think it's this, it's actually this. And there's something about being ripped very quickly out of your comfort zone by these two really beautiful stories woven together at the very beginning, be like, okay, I need to lean into this in a different way. And Sheila's is, it's a powerful story. But you're exactly right. The forgiveness aspect of that, could I have forgiven? Like, I don't know that I could have done what she's done. And the fact that she's vulnerable enough to share it, and then the fact that she overcame it and continues, it's not a glossy version of her life right now either. You know, she's still working through, is I think a reminder for a lot of us that this is a process and that there's hope in that process.
And she also was not alone in her healing, right?
Yeah.
Like that. So without getting too much deeper into this one story, I mean, there's every single story we could go super deep into, which again lends to why these stories are excellent for conversation and grappling in small groups, you know, in schools. But there is also the addition of somebody else there to support and there to bring out, and that's a common theme in all 14 of your stories. I truly think so. And anyhow, before we get into the person wearing the collar, who is a very big name through line in this feature as well, so another huge value added, this need for coming together and to be able to discuss topics such as, and I'm going to list a few topics that come into my mind from having seen your movie, and I would love for you to fill in others that might also be part of this list. I see hope. I see challenge. I see redemption. I see forgiveness. I see grit. Mm-hmm. I see faith. Is there anything that I'm
leaving
out?
Like willingness. You know, I think that's a theme that happens throughout this, is that there's a chapter called Answering the Call, right? Like, there's a willingness to, when the moment comes up, to be available in some way to whatever that need is. I think resilience is a big one. But I think hope is the biggest one for me, is that the antagonist, we've always said the antagonist is the film, is the societal ills that we're all experiencing together. It doesn't matter where we are on the spectrum of any part of life. We're all universally experiencing the same social ills, and that's the antagonist, not a group or an individual. It's the societal things. And I think when we come from that shared experience and now acknowledge that it's been kind of a rough run recently, that hope becomes a really powerful thing in that, and not in a Pollyannish kind of way. And I think that's the honesty of these stories, to have hope be the through line through these challenging stories, shows that they can both coexist. And I love that.
And you just got me thinking about how none of these stories, except for actually Tim, mm-hmm. in the first chapter with his ALS, he's able to communicate through technology.
Yeah.
In none of the other stories is technology really playing such a central role. And I'm not mm-hmm. demonizing technology.
No.
But, and in fact, mm-hmm. the way you use it, the way that Tim uses it is so yep. vaulted. It's fantastic. Yep. And what I'm getting at is that it's also community. It's also, I guess we mentioned before, just how Sheila doesn't go it alone. There's somebody yep. who comes in to help her. All of your 14 everyday people doing mm-hmm. extraordinary things aren't in a vacuum. Mm-hmm. They yep. have others, and they're building community. And I was thinking about that when you mm-hmm. were sharing the fact that we've all been through this period of isolation. We've all been through this period of complete anxiety and trauma, frankly, during yep. the pandemic, and certainly during these past 3 to 4 years, if not longer, actually, in certain ways. And yet this movie absolutely reminds us that we are human beings.
Yep.
And we, therefore, are not able to go it alone
yeah.
Through life. We
yeah.
we need to find a healthy trust in others. We need to look for their better angels. We need to find moments of grace mm-hmm. that come through interplay between people. And in order to do that, I wonder what you have to say about this, about the idea of humility, the idea of acknowledging our imperfections
mm-hmm.
and this idea that by acknowledging them, we can actually, if we point our compass the right direction, achieve even yeah. greater things.
Yeah.
Is there any yeah. thoughts about it's, that in the movie?
Well, I feel like I live in that space. You know, as we talked a little bit before, I think that's why it was so important to me. It would have been much easier to have had 4 talking points about unselfish love, found 10 experts, had them make those talking points, and we edited it together. We would have been done in 3 months, right? Like, through the lens of vulnerability and imperfection, I think allowing people to wrestle with this, it's a messier thing to do a story where we don't define what you need to walk away with, that we allow you to wrestle with that yourself. Like, that's a terrifying thing. And some people want more clarity. They want to be told so they can go and just do the thing. But I think that's what's beautiful about this is that vulnerability and that community aspect of that. So, you know, we went on this story, on this journey, and like you say, there are 14 deep dive stories. There's 250 plus men on the streets. There's 14 cameos, and then there's, you know, Bishop Curry. And to your point, I think when we hit the road, there was 8 of us in 3 vans with a bunch of gear in the middle of COVID. We had just had that first vaccine. So there was enough of a window where we felt safe enough to do that, but before the next spike had hit, we had maybe 3 or 4 of those stories lined up. So it really was starting that process, and then somebody would say, oh my gosh, you're going to Indianapolis, you've got to talk to Sheila, or you're going to be in Jacksonville, you need to talk to. And I think there was something really beautiful and terrifying about that. Because every single stop, I didn't know any of these people in this film. And I would go into their home, and your first job is to make the space safe enough for them to be vulnerable enough to tell their story. And that's a big lift. And then when they do feel safe enough, the things that they share are things we would have never even known to have brought up. And I think there's hunger for that. I think there's hunger for people to be heard, not just to be told. And I think that's what I got to witness along the way, is that all I did was listen day after day after day, whether it was a 3-minute on the street thing or a full day in somebody's home. The power of listening changes that dynamic too.
I'm thinking about how that perfectly sums up. Okay, so we're exercising our skills in listening. Yeah. We're exercising our skills in broadening our sense of other people's experiences, individual experiences. Mm-hmm. We're sharing experience together through this film. All of that lends itself 100% to a school environment,
yeah,
whether it's homeroom or advisory or any sort of space built into the school schedule where students can come together in small groups, mm-hmm, and watch a clip, watch a, yep, chapter, discuss it in a classroom environment that's optimized, mm-hmm, for safety, yep, and belongingness, yep, right? That's, mm-hmm, what Reach, Teach, Talk is all about. Yep. It's relationships in the classroom, how we use a relational pedagogy to promote safety in the, mm-hmm, classroom, because through safety comes, you know, yeah, vulnerability, but through safety also comes risk-taking, yep, and exploration. Mm-hmm. And this movie, if nothing else, absolutely calls upon us to explore the journey of the heart, explore what it means to love thy neighbor, explore what it means to be a loving person. So just to reiterate how perfectly suited, yeah, this film is for bringing school cultures together, a school culture together in the spirit of positivity and the spirit of love, through these 14 very relatable, yeah, if not the specifics, certainly the themes, relatable themes to for all members of a school, yeah, community. And in fact, is there anything to help teachers along the way?
Exactly. It's funny you talk about that.
Yes.
So yes, I think our goal from the very beginning was we did not want to make a piece of media where somebody was entertained or emotionally moved for 2 hours and then they went back to life. Like, what have we done if that's the only thing that we accomplished? So it really was, can we create a tool that through questions and listening and story provoke something, stir up something, and then we can hand it off to people who do that work beautifully? Because
you are a teacher.
Yeah.
You are a teacher, but in a certain way.
But so what I love about that is, so then when we got to talk a little bit of like, okay, Nat, you know this world, like you're immersed in it. So what can we do? And right away it was, okay, well, as this thing has already been built into chapters, then can we create conversation around a particular chapter, question by question, that's unique to the language of this audience? And you have that gift. And so I was thrilled that now we have this discussion guide that's part discussion guide that breaks into the chapters and has questions that grown out of those chapters. But then the second half of that is this journal. And part of what our goal is with this is we're launching a month of unselfish love on the January 23rd at the screening. That's our launch.
Tell us about that.
Yes.
A month of unselfish love. What does that entail?
A month of unselfish love. So and this started from our CFO, who is a finance background, very organized type A person. And he has this list on his whiteboard every day of like, here's the tasks I need to achieve. And he can cross them off and he finds success through that. And so he said, what would it look like if I, in my list of tasks, added a bullet point, which was intentionally seeking out some act of good that I could do that day? And what would that change? How would that impact my life? So he started doing that. And he said by the sixth or seventh day, it became a habit. And you no longer need the whiteboard. You're already kind of seeking out the opportunity to check that off the list. And so we wanted, it works. And so we wanted that to be available to people as well. So the second half of that discussion guide is, okay, first part, let's have these conversations and wrestle with it. And then now let's take action and see what that can do to our life. And the other part of it that is you come back to the classroom that I think is really impactful. Like, I've been thinking about this a lot since we've had these conversations. And I think the initial sense is like, okay, can kids see themselves in these stories? And what is the good in that and the challenge in that? The other part of it is because most of these stories are adults. is that I think there's also value for young people to, while the kids are probably not going to have experienced some of these things that the adults have, they're products of parents who have. And I think that it creates empathy. Like when I think of, okay, if I know their parents are a military parent and I watch Christina's story, like I'm going to start seeing Joey a little different than I, hopefully a little different than I did before I saw that story. Or if I know that Scott does not come from means in any way, then by seeing Sheila's story or some of these other stories where you see what people are forced to do when they feel like they'd have no other options. And what does that mean to be a product of that? Like hopefully empathy translates. So I think there's the direct thing of maybe my friends or my classmates are relatable to the story itself. And then there's also the next level where they're a generation away from that. And I can understand that better and engage with that better through watching that, if that makes sense.
It makes total sense. And it also circles back to the beginning of our conversation about your origin story regarding being a filmmaker and what brought you to movies and what you saw as a younger person working in the movie theater, what you saw about the power of movies and how they, that power is the ability to step into somebody else's shoes, even if you're not yet of that age, right? You're not from that background. You're not. It's the empathy that gets produced when you're actually really, really stepping in. Mm-hmm. It's like with literature or visual films. It's amazing. So who is the man in the white collar, and how does this character serve as a through line in A Case for Love?
So, again, we knew from the beginning that like it was not going to be my role to be teacher. So we knew that we needed somebody to land the plane. And so the impetus for this story is this individual named the Bishop Michael Curry. And he's the presiding bishop of the Episcopal Church, the National Episcopal Church. And many people would know him because he did the sermon for the royal wedding for Harry and Meghan.
Not just any sermon.
Not
that,
just any sermon.
That
a few people
elevating.
Watched that sermon.
And wow, what a sermon.
all over the world. I think over 4 billion people watched that sermon. And his message has been, as I interpret it, that we have got to figure out as human beings how to live into this idea of unselfish love. And this is not a Christian thing or a Jewish thing or Muslim or religious. It's a human being thing. And we're seeing the effects of that not happening in society right now. So he's preached about it. He's spoken about it. He's been all over the world talking about it. And he would say over and over again, he's a one-note Charlie, right? Like that is his message. And it struck me. It's a powerful message to hear. And I think as COVID was beginning and really taking off, like the notions of that became even more important because we got ripped away from human beings. You know, we got, especially in the bigger cities, you know, for me in Los Angeles, that bubble became really, really small. And your source of interaction with people became social media and your news. And that's not a good thing. So when we were approached about making this, I think the notion of it was he was writing a book, and it was the book was half his life, half his message. And I think when they were looking at it, they said, okay, it's one thing to preach about it or write books about it, but it's a whole nother thing to actually be with people and explore what does this notion of unselfish love actually mean. And that excited me. I'm a hopeful person by nature. I grew up in the Midwest. I live in Los Angeles. I have family members that are on all parts of the political spectrum and social spectrum. And that's important to me. And I'm grateful for that. It's formulated who I am now and this desire to tell stories that bring people together. But that's where the heart of all of this came from. And so for the film, for us, it was, okay, this message, this heart inspired the story. And then now our job was to go on the road and explore. And then ultimately, after 14 deep dive stories, 200 plus men on the streets, 14 interviews with notable figures, we got to sit down with Bishop Curry and say, okay, here's what we saw. Like, what does this mean? Let's unpack it.
This is literally a part in the movie, by the way. Yeah. It's exactly how you just said. Okay, here's what we saw.
Exactly.
What does this mean? Let's unpack it.
Yes. You land
Roll.
The blame.
Exactly.
Yes. Yeah. Hand it
the
over.
The ultimate delegator.
Yeah. And he's like, that's his gift. And he's on the Today Show all the time. And it's not because he's a big religious figure. He just speaks so beautifully into the human condition. And he did it. in this film as well.
He does, and it's brilliant. I love the through line. So it's you know, these 14 stories are connected, interwoven.
Yeah.
With this through line that Bishop Michael Curry kind of brings us back to this case for love and this, you know, thinking about unselfish love and how it applies. And also as a through line, you have the man on the street, woman on the street, person on the street, sharing their answer to the simple question of what is unselfish love. On film, it's fascinating to watch because there are so many answers. Yeah. But not just answers, but it's the reactions to the question.
Yes.
Can you speak about that? How was it to be on the other end of the camera for those questions?
I think in many ways, this is probably my favorite part of the process. And because we were everywhere, downtown Indianapolis, or a farm that we just pulled over to in Pennsylvania, or the Brooklyn Bridge, or small town. In the first moment, I mean, it's a big camera package that we're carrying around. And I think people are standoffish initially, right? Like, we've all seen the Borat movies enough to know that you're going to make me look like an idiot. I don't want any part of this. So I think our first task was always to, how do we create trust in what this is? And then once they trusted you, and it's not indifferent to what happened in people's homes, but once they trusted you, the first response almost always was, you want to know what I think? Like, nobody asked me what I think, and I was just walking to the grocery store, going to get gas, or mowing my yard, and there was something beautiful about the acknowledgement that I have value, and that there's this group from Los Angeles with all this fancy stuff. At the end of the day, they want to know what I think, and I'm in my front yard mowing my yard. So I loved that, and I think when people feel that, they share differently because of that. Yeah,
the educator in me.
Yeah.
Is just on fire right now, because that is what we aspire for all of our students, is that reflexive, wait, you really want to know what I think?
Yeah.
And how you get to that belief in a student that the student truly believes you care about what they think is everything.
It is.
That is so amazing. Yeah. And that's again, really, really, really please consider A Case for Love in your schools, because those moments are guaranteed to percolate. They'll take place because of the content of this movie. Yeah. And absolutely, the person on the street is a micro example of what would happen in the classroom in a small group setting for students and teachers. I love that.
Yeah, I love it too. I get chills thinking about it because it brings back that feeling of doing it.
Well, look, I we're going to wrap this up really shortly, but I just wanted to, is there anything you want to say about the other folks who are kind of featured in this film besides Bishop Michael Curry and how you came to select, or how they came to you and what differentiates them from the person on the street answering the question, what is unselfish love?
Yeah. The film, the deep dive stories, these 14 that you talked about, are 95% of the film. And we did that intentionally because we wanted ordinary people to watch the film and see ordinary people as the heroes of the film and feel like, okay, I can do that too. If it was just filled with a bunch of CEOs and remarkable NGO leaders, then it'd be like, well, good for you, but I'm never going to be the CEO of something.
Relatable.
So that was super important to us. What I loved about The Man on the Streets is that it allowed us some color in that, of like the unpredictability of that. But then we knew that we also wanted to have some notable figures, that these people, they have weight for good reason, because they've done things and they've weathered things and they've seen things. And so some of those are political, and we have people from the left and people from the right. Some of those are religious leaders. We have Christian leaders and Muslim leaders and Jewish leaders in this. We have actors from Hollywood in this that, you know, have gone through this through the lens of media and the things they've learned from that. We have NGO leaders in here. And what they just did beautifully is they succinctly echoed the things that the deep dives allowed us time to simmer in and let bubble up slowly. The notable figures could more succinctly kind of echo some of those points. And so the river flowed beautifully with those. That's the core of what's in this. Those four groups: the deep dives, the man on the streets, the notable figures, and then ultimately with Bishop Michael Curry.
the river flowed beautifully with their input, and that's exactly how it feels to watch this beautiful movie, Brian. I feel like every time I've watched it, I felt like I'm going with the river, going with the current that's going to end up in a really safe place, in a place where I can reflect on what I just saw. And it's harmonious. I mean, it's a beautiful kind of message in a beautiful way that it's communicated through the movie. Yeah. And it is just brilliant. I cannot wait for after January 23rd to start being made aware of how this movie is making its way out into different communities, school communities, church communities, civic group communities, you know, retirement communities. Yeah. Like, you know, we're all on this journey together. And if nothing else, this movie calls us to action in a certain way, to really lead with our heart and to decide with our heart what unselfish love is. I'll leave it for you to have the final word on A Case for Love. Yeah. I'm so, so pleased that you were here on Reach Talk today.
And I'm grateful. So I guess my final things would, as you said, is A Case for Love comes out in 1,000 theaters on January 23rd, and it's a single day as of right now. It's released by Fathom Events, and that's how they create their distribution platforms.
Fathom Events.
Fathom Events. Okay. And so the website for the film, the movie is called A Case for Love, and the website is just acaseforlovemovie.com. And there's where you can find out where it's playing, how to buy tickets, and all of that. I think even for educators, what I love and am so grateful about the theatrical release, because it's a rare thing to be given for a film, especially a film like this, is that if all we did was watch a movie like this at home on a streaming platform or on our computers alone, then we miss the first part of this, which is a shared experience in community. And then how do we now dialogue and engage with that? So I would encourage educators and schools to invite their students to come out on the 23rd. There's 4 o'clock showings and 7 o'clock showings. Because it's on the big screen, right? It's after school. And it's on the big screen, and it's just, it's different when there's no distractions in life and you're sitting in a row with other folks having the shared experience. Ultimately, there will be opportunities to screen it in other ways too, and the distribution companies will kind of dictate the when and the how of all that. And we absolutely want to be in schools and be curated in ways that they can use in-house. But we do invite people. It's meaningful. The industry takes note of it, and more of these kind of stories get told when they see that there's an audience that desires it. So we just encourage folks, you can go to the website, see all those places, and then find a theater in their local area.
The first time I saw A Case for Love, it actually was in a local premiere in LA here a couple months ago, and it was in a big theater. And as much as I remember the movie, I also even just as much remember walking out of the theater and down the sidewalk with a parade of people who had just seen it. People were barely walking. Yeah. Like, they were standing in their own tracks, engaged in conversation. Which one do you think was most powerful for you? What is the feeling? What do you think society is lacking most today? Mm-hmm. How can I be a better person through emulating what this this person was doing? Isn't it amazing that these are regular people like us who are inspiring me in such a deep way? Mm-hmm. I want to take this and do something with it. What do I do? Like, all those questions I was hearing on the gritty sidewalk in Hollywood after watching this movie and this film. So, January 23rd, 2024, 12324. Yes. Come out to the theaters. Come out and watch this movie. Talk about it. Get a group together. You know, get together at a cafe afterwards. Talk about it more. This is a very important film, and it is an absolutely inspiring film. We need inspiration. Yeah. We need to move out of this darkness and into, I mean, that beautiful, beautiful, you know, poster behind you here.
Yes.
Illustrating that. We need to move away from the thunder and out into the dawn, the beautiful sunlight. So, Brian, thanks for making this happen, and I can't wait to see you again after January 23rd, 2024. Thank you so much, and thank you, everybody, listeners and viewers, for tuning in to Reach Teach Talk. This is our 43rd episode. Cannot be more proud to have Mr. Brian Eady from Grace-Based Productions speaking with us today about the case, A Case for Love.
You've been listening to Reach Teach Talk with Nat Damon. If you'd like to recommend a guest for a future episode, you can send your suggestion or questions to nat@reachacademics.com.